calls this Policy and Finance Committee to order for Tuesday, April 10th. We have the minutes before us from March 29th. Representative Uglum, in honor of the Bulldogs' victory in the NCAA Championship Hockey game, would you care to move the minutes?
You are so correct, sir, and I will move the minutes.
All right. Thank you. Those in favor of the minutes as presented by Representative Uglum in honor of the Bulldogs, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, minutes are approved. Next, members, just one housekeeping thing real quick in case I forget at the end. Next week, obviously, we have to have our bill put together, and we'll announce that early next week. And we have a deadline, I believe it's Friday the 20th, that we have to have that passed out of our committee. So that's what we'll be doing next week. So stay tuned, okay? And then I'd like to recognize Bob Meyer here real quick with LifeSource CEO Susan Gunderson, I believe. So go ahead.
Chairman, members, actually, it's not the CEO, but close to it. So for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. And I just wanted to take a moment to recognize you all for helping us achieve an award that we received from LifeSource over the weekend on Donate Life Day. We were recognized for the Legislative Impact Award, the Department of Natural Resources, for something that you guys actually did, and we just took it and implemented it. Several years ago, Representative Phyllis Kahn had the idea of requiring the DNR to issue or to ask people if they wanted to be an organ donor at the point of sale of all licensed hunting and fishing licenses. We worked with LifeSource and others the next session to come up with language that would allow us to require or ask people when they're online buying a hunting or fishing license to see if they want to be a donor. We implemented that, and we were very, very successful. So with that, I'd like to introduce Susan Mao Larson and also Steve Michaels from our licensing division who actually implemented this, and they actually get the credit along with you. So I just...
It was a pretty face. I got to accept the award, so I'll pass that around to you.
Pretty face. Not pretty, I guess.
Thank you, Bob. Mr.
Good morning.
Chair,
thank you.
Members, thank you. My name is Susan Mao Larson, and it's really my privilege to work with LifeSource. We're the nonprofit organization in Minnesota that's dedicated every day to helping save and heal lives through organ tissue and eye donation. A big part of our work is to advocate for a donation and encourage more people to register as donors to make that decision during their lifetime. While we've done great in Minnesota, we've also had great challenges in trying to increase that further. So we were thrilled a few years ago when the Department of Natural Resources, under Bob Meyer's leadership, really came forward and partnered with us to make this happen. So thank you all for your support in passing this legislation. To date, we've had more than 30,000 people register as donors on their hunting fishing license. In 1 year, that's incredibly significant. This is a kind of growth in registration that we had not seen before. We, as you know, are the first state in the nation to do this, and we're just talking this morning. We get calls from other states on a weekly basis asking us how we did it and trying to follow suit. So we think Minnesota is a real trailblazer in this effort. And I really want to thank both Assistant Commissioner Meyer for his leadership and Steve Michaels for all his work in making this happen and putting this into place. So we're very excited about it, thrilled by the success. We know fishing season is coming up again, so we have another chance to encourage people to register. And I really believe, and this is the words I'm going to quote Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer, it's successful because this is about legacies. And hunting and fishing is certainly a legacy that is passed on from parents to children. And donation is a legacy that's passed on from one generous individual to another in need. So thank you for helping us to continue those legacies.
Thank you. As a former health teacher back in my real life, before I started to do this, I had the LifeSource people come to my health class and talk about the program. And I do have my donor on my driver's license. And, oh, by the way, you mentioned fishing season is coming. Members and people watching here, I'll be checking to see if you have your walleye stamps after the season is open. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. Comments from the members?
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for the great work you do. It's awesome.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Lewick, House File 3648. Representative Lewick to House File 3648. It's the intention of the chair to lay this over for possible inclusion. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. What House File 3648 does is it fixes a kind of an administrative glitch on how we deal with snowmobile safety training and how you purchase that online. We want to make sure that it's seamless and continues to work well out here. It's not a major, just a few word change in how we do things. But anyway, what I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, is go ahead and shift the testifier here. They can explain in more detail how it impacts our safety training folks out there in the snowmobile world.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Doug Franzen, and I'm representing the Minnesota United Snowmobile Association. I want to thank the representative for bringing this forward. It's a bill that's short in words, but really important in impact. We are dedicated as snowmobilers to snowmobile safety, and we know there are three things really that are the most effective contributors to a safe recreational experience. One is good trails, the other is strong enforcement, but probably most important is training. And on that pyramid of training, the very peak or the pinnacle is youth training. There's two segments to a young person being trained to ride a snowmobile. One is the online, which until a few years ago was a CD experience, and the hands-on, which we partner with the conservation officers with volunteer trainers where they can actually get on a machine, see how they work, and how you can actually operate them safely. I mentioned the CDs a couple years ago. The department stopped issuing CDs, which they distributed free, for two reasons. One, it cost the state money, but more importantly, the evolution of computers, most all of them no longer have a DVD or a CD drive. So it was obsolete technology. The department went to an online platform with two vendors. They worked with us in doing this. The only problem with going online is the vendor would charge, not DNR, but the vendor would charge $30 per child. So it went from free to $30, which was, in our mind at least, discouraged kids from taking snowmobile safety training, and particularly with families that may have two, three, or even four children. One vendor said, well, the first one will do a friends and family discount. The first the first code, if you will, to get into the safety program is $30, but then you can buy as many as you need for $10 each. What had happened is our volunteer instructors started buying a bunch of them, 10 or 20 at a time, and then passing them through to the kids, so the kids or their parents would pay $10 rather than $30. This has worked fairly well to encourage snowmobile safety training for kids. It makes it much more accessible for a lot of folks. The difficulty is it's not quite legal because our safety training that our volunteers do is not a money-making venture. We do it for free. We charge them a few bucks for the materials they get. And Minnesota law limits how much money we can charge someone. So if we charge them, say, $5 for the materials they have, and then an additional $10, even though the family saves $20, we've broken the law. And as Representative Lewick has said, it's an administrative glitch, a technicality. We've been working with the DNR. I have not heard their testimony yet, but I think they're in support. And we'd appreciate your support. This is a good government, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Yep. Bob Meyer? Where is he hiding? Where's that pretty face at? There it is.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. We do support this bill. I think Mr. Franzen did a good job outlining the challenges that we're facing, trying to get low-cost options for these children or individuals to be trained for safety training on snowmobiles. So whatever we can do to deal with that, and we think it's a good approach.
Great. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, looking at the bill, it looks like the change in laws on 2.13 and 2.14, and I listened to Mr. Franzen's summary of what his intent was. And maybe this is a question for Mr. Meyer. How does the change in law actually make that work?
Mr. Meyer?
How would this actually practically work?
Mr. Chairman, I need to go through
it. We have a phone offender or two to my left, just in case.
And I might need Ms. Taylor's assistance. But in statute, it basically says that the instructors can't charge any more than the course costs. Yeah. And then there's other pieces that allow them to capture costs of, like, their refreshments and things like that, which is up to the cost of the class. And that's for the firearms program, which runs over into these other programs as well. But this is allowing them to do it, as Mr. Franzen discussed, to capture all of those costs paid by that instructor for the online training course. So, and then the established fee amount for class materials and expenses is what I was referring to previously. So this is actually just referring to that online training course cost. One of the things I just want to make you aware of, that previously there were two vendors. Those two vendors have joined each other now, so we're only dealing with one vendor. That may increase costs into the future as we are doing some of these bulk purchases. So I think this is a good way for us to get ahead of that curve a little bit, as we may need to come back and look at other statutes into the future.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, Commissioner Meyer, on that particular point, because this, I think, is relevant for some other issues, that you as the DNR select the vendor through a RFP process, so it's not, is it a sole source contract, or is it they have to bid for it every couple years, or how, could you maybe just explain how that works?
Chairman, members, it is an RFP, so it's not a sole source contract. We do put it out for bid, and it does come up, I believe, about every 3 years or so, with opportunity to extend those contracts as well. Colonel Smith is in charge of that. His division is dealing with that. He's unfortunately under the weather today, so we can circle back with Key and I and yourself, Representative Hansen, if you have additional questions on that line.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, my reason for asking this is on a different bill, but looking at issues with vendors doing training, I'm just looking for precedent and experience elsewhere on how the state responds to that. You don't identify the vendor in statute or in law or even in rule. You have your existing commissioner authority to make a choice. Is that correct?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, that's our desire, yes. Unfortunately, there's some areas where there is only one vendor, then we still have to do an RFP. There's other underlying statutes in Chapter 16 as well. Dealing with cost recovery, you can't overcharge or undercharge for cost of services. So that's kind of like the prevailing statute. And then we come in with these other ones.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Other questions, members? Okay. Representative Luig, any closing comments on your bill?
No, other than thank you, members and the chair and testifiers.
All right, thank you. With that, House File 3648 is laid over. Thank you. All right, next up. That pretty face again. Good morning. DNR is here to walk us through their supplemental budget request and give us an overview.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Again, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Barb Julek, our CFO.
And Mr. Meyer, before you do that, let's House File 3908. No, my problem. Okay, very good. Go ahead. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to sort of turn this over to Barb Julek to walk through the, you should have in your packet a budget brief which outlines the governor's recommendations for the DNR supplemental budget.
The Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Barb Julek, the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Natural Resources, and I'll be walking through the Governor's recommendations, which includes four supplemental spending proposals totaling $3,879,000 and one proposal that has a revenue fiscal note on it. This budget request represents a 0.3% increase. I don't know if this is working, in the budget that was passed last year to supplement the 18-19 budget. These proposals address urgent needs relating to continued response to chronic wasting disease, increased forest inventory for improved forest management, and proposals that advance the governor's clean water goals. The recommendations also include requests for authorizations of land sales, which were in the lands bill and have a revenue estimate. First proposal, walkthrough, is relating to chronic wasting disease. This is a request for $1,560,000 in one-time general funds for the continued response relating to wildlife disease. These funds, like I stated, would support DNR's ongoing efforts responding to the current CWD findings in southeast and central Minnesota with the goal of preventing further spread and eradicating the disease. When CWD is detected in wild deer, our response plan calls for strategies that reduce deer densities, such as deer hunts and testing of removed deer. Continuous monitoring is required until testing results in no positive tests over 3 years, for three consecutive years. When CWD is discovered in farms, hunter-harvested deer near a positive farmer tested for CWD, and again, we're looking for three consecutive years with zero positive results. As you are aware, in 2016, we did detect CWD in three wild deer in southeastern Minnesota. Since then, we have been increasing our sampling and our testing of hunter-harvested deer, and we have continued to find confirmed cases. In addition, we have found confirmed cases in three farms throughout central and southern Minnesota. Current disease surveillance is typically paid with game and fish operating funds and the emergency deer feeding and wild service health account. Last year, you did provide $500,000 in one-time funding through the Heritage Enhancement Account appropriation, and there was some funding provided through the Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund. Since 2016, we have spent over $1.9 million, which is above and beyond those two one-time appropriations. And so far in fiscal 18, year-to-date spending has exceeded $1 million. We need to continue our surveillance, sampling, and deer control activities related to CWD, and we'll be looking for ongoing funding strategies for next biennium with the biennial budget cycle. But at this point in time, we are looking for an additional one-time appropriation to get us through state fiscal year 19. Specifically, these funds would be used, $1.1 million would be dedicated towards sampling efforts, including $500,000 in sampling and testing in the Fillmore County area, and then $600,000 for the sampling related to the three deer farms that were located in Crow Wing, Meeker, and Winona counties. In addition, funding would also be allocated for deer control activities, either through land order or contracted shooting programs, and then funding for the enforcement response implementation of containment efforts if there are escaped deer from farms. The next proposal would be a forest inventory proposal. This request is for $1 million in general funds to improve forest inventory on state lands. This would allow an additional 100,000 acres to be inventoried each year on top of the current 120,000 acres. With this additional inventory funding, we can reduce our inventory cycle to 15 years and improve our forest data. Improved forest data will allow more accurate and reliable modeling of forest management options. Forest inventory has been identified as an immediate need to improve forest planning and analysis efforts. Of the $1 million request, which would be an annual request, $950,000 would go toward increased forest capacity, both through contracted services and increased internal staffing. And $50,000 would go toward ongoing purchase and replacement of equipment, including maintenance software and training of the new equipment in order to standardize and improve our data collection methods. The third request is a clean water request. This is a request for $1 million one time out of the Clean Water Fund for the Forest of the Future programs. This program was established by the legislature in 2008 to identify and protect private and working forests. These funds would support strategic protection of up to 1,000 acres of private forest lands using forest conservation easements and fee title acquisitions to protect water quality in Minnesota lakes, rivers, streams, and groundwater. Mr. Chair, the next budget proposal is a proposal for $319,000 to be annually appropriated from the mineral management account, which is part of the Natural Resources Fund. This would be used to continue our research on environmental effects of mining. This proposal would restore funding for research that has been lost over the prior years due to the loss of voluntary industry match. As you may recall, prior to fiscal year 17, DNR's appropriation for mining research was restricted to the amounts it could match with industry donations. Those match funds have gone away over the past few years. You did, in the last 2 years, eliminate the need to receive a match in order to spend the funds. However, the appropriation that currently exists is only half of what we would operate under when we had a match. So this request would request the $319,000 as an appropriation, bringing the total program to $638,000. To allow funding for research project to go back to historical levels. And Mr. Chair, the last proposal is related to the lands bill, which I believe was heard the other day. This is just the estimated revenue associated with the land transactions that we are seeking authorization for, and it's an estimated revenue of $61,000 that would be deposited into the land acquisition account according to statute.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. You're looking for more money for chronic wasting disease. How much was in the last budget for that?
Ms. Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, there were a one-time appropriation of $500,000 out of the Heritage Enhancement was given for fiscal year 18, which will be spent by the end of this year. There was an Environmental Natural Trust Fund appropriation originally of $350,000, and then an additional $99,000 was given as well. And then to the extent that doesn't meet the needs, we do tap into our operating budgets of the Game and Fish operating account and the Servant Health account.
Representative Green. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what was the total that you spent, that you will be spending in 2018 then?
Mr. Chair, in fiscal year 18, we have spent over $1 million so far. We would expect to spend probably another $300,000 to $400,000.
Representative Green.
Right, thank you. And then on your forestry, you're looking for $1 million there. And can you walk through a little bit more detail as to what you're going to be doing differently than what you're doing now? And why you need more FTEs and how many you're going to need, because you said you're going to put on more staff.
Yes.
So how much of the million is going to go for staff?
Ms. Buick.
Mr. Chair, currently we inventory about 120,000 acres per year. I believe this allows for a 20-year inventory cycle. And of that 120, about 70,000 acres is conducted internally with staff, and 50,000 is done with contracts. This proposal would have us add four FTEs to increase our inventory. Three of those FTEs would be dedicated to increasing our capacity and inventory on 45,000 acres, and then the balance, 50,000 acres, would be done by contract. And then one additional FTE would be provided for to do coordination of the inventory and do quality control analysis of the data results.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you get me a breakdown of what the exact acres you're talking about there? Some of the information you just told me, but also why, if you're going to increase the acres, but you must be talking acres per year, and so I'd like to know how many you're doing a year now, and what the increase is going to mean. And where those, what the responsibility is specifically those four FTEs are. And then the other question I have is kind of broad over the whole request, and that is, weren't these things taken into consideration when you came through your budget last year?
Mr. Licker, Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, again, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This request really comes from our analysis with our sustainable timber harvest work with our contractors. You know, you can only throw a dart so close to a dartboard, and that dartboard is the data that you have, right? So it's really recognizing the fact that we don't have the most current inventory data that we need. Currently, we're doing about 120,000 acres of inventory data annually, about 70,000 by staff and 50,000 via contracts. This proposal would allow us to ramp up an additional 100,000 acres of DNR land to be inventoried annually, improving our inventory data resolution, so the screen of the data that we have. What we saw is that, you know, through our sustainable timber harvest, which we presented to the committee, we can tell what we have based upon the data that we have, but I think there's some people who think we have different types of trees or bigger trees or more trees on the land than what we actually, our data is telling us. So this proposal would allow us to kind of sharpen our pencil, give us a better understanding of the trees and the types of trees and the sizes, the age classes that are on state lands to allow for more sustainable timber harvest levels into the future.
Representative Green. Thank you. Can you explain to me the difference between what you do in-house and the contracts and what the difference in price is?
Commissioner Meyer, Mr. Chairman, we'll have to get that information, but I don't have the contract prices, the acres or anything like that, but we'll pull together information for you on that.
Representative Green. Okay. Next, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
I'm looking at the chronic wasting disease, and you are talking about looking out 3 years and making sure that nothing happens in 3 years. But what we've had in other testimony is that the prions that are can get into the ground can last much longer than that. So I am worried that you're not doing it for longer than 3 years. Should I be worried?
Mr. Meyerman, Representative Wagenius, you are correct that the prions last indefinitely. Right? It's not like weather or anything will kill them. Most of the issues where we have found the prions to date are within private servant farms. So we need to work and make sure that those farms, if they are bought out through the USDA program, or if they keep operating after they've been infested, or detected, I should say, that they're being monitored and the fences and everything are up to speed. So we need to be concerned that the Pine Island facility down on 52, which was a large elk farm, still has fences up to date, and that was, you know, a decade and a half ago probably or so, decade ago, where that herd was basically destroyed. So we need to continue that. Our goal is to, where we find these issues or these situations, to monitor for a consecutive time period until we have a clean slate for 3 years. So, for example, in Crow Wing County, we did an intensive surveillance program last hunting season, and we didn't find any detection. There was no diseased animals found. So we're going to back off this year a little bit, and then next year, if we're clean again, we'll feel the need that we've managed that infestation, hopefully, and we won't be monitoring at that level in that area. So we can't afford to monitor forever, but we feel that 3 years is a good enough time for a clean bill of health, so to speak, in an area that we should be okay.
Dr. Walking, yes?
Well, just following up on that, so you're making a distinction between what's in the wild and that old farm, and you're keeping that sequestered, am I understanding? So that that's probably the source of contamination, and is that what you're doing?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, that's the way it's supposed to work, yes.
Supposed to work? that scares me. If I could...
You can.
So that should be the way it's working. I mean, from your testimony and from what we've heard in other testimonies, it seems that each of those areas where a deer farm has been need to be fenced off pretty much for a long time. I don't know what a long time is, but certainly more than 3 years. So are we assured that that's happening?
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukinius, that is a good question. In the case of the Winona herd that we found, the entire herd, which was seven animals, to be infested with CWD recently, I would say, that herd was destroyed, and they participated in the USDA buyout program. So now the question is, who is responsible to maintain or to ensure that that fence, once it's brought up to code, is maintained for a period of time, which, you know, I think it's 5 years, which is not long enough, in my opinion. But, and those are questions we're having with the Board of Animal Health right now. Whose responsibility is it to maintain or to monitor, inspect, is the right term, these fences after a herd may be bought out or after there are no more animals in there, but we know that the area is contaminated.
Representative Rukinius.
Well, it does seem to me that as part of the buyout, that needs to be, I like the direction you're going in, and I agree with you that 5 years is not enough, but it does seem that that has to be part of the buyout, and I'm not hearing about the responsibility of the folks who own the farm. And and that was my other question. So we are paying for sampling in farms. Why aren't they paying for the sampling themselves?
Madam Chair, we're sampling in the areas around the farms, but actually inside of the farm. The only way you can do a CWD test is to test the brain tissue. So we have to have a harvested animal or a deceased animal to test. So we're testing all of the hunter harvested deer around those locations where we found a hot or a contaminated farm.
Representative Wilkins.
I think maybe we need to spend some more time on making sure these areas are absolutely sequestered. That feels like something that's dropping off the table.
Sure, and I'm looking forward to the OLA's report that's coming out next week. I think I forwarded to you this morning the finding of the release of that report. I think it's going to be a linchpin, one more block in this building that we're putting together with regards to CWD. Next, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, we have some dollars that you're talking about being appropriated going forward towards looking for CWD and doing testing, and I thought the way that it was done the last time in Crow Wing County specifically really was a great way to go, where you're timing the testing in conjunction with the Minnesota Deer Hunt. Is that the plan with the dollars that you're asking for currently?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heintz, yes, and specifically we'll concentrate on the opening first couple of days, since that's when most of the deer are harvested, but we're trying to figure out our protocol is designed to receive the maximum amount of samples with the most participation possible in the cheapest way possible. So we focus on the openings of the seasons and try to get a statistically valid number of samples in those first couple of days, if at all possible.
Mr. Hanson, follow up.
That's it, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just wanted to point that out. In case we were talking about sharpshooters, sometimes people get a little bit sensitive to the idea of that. So timing it around the deer hunt makes, I think, a lot of sense.
Mr. Chairman, that's our priority for sure.
Yep. Thank you. Representative Beckerfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will not surprise you as kind of a follow-up to what Representative Wagenius was asking about. So of the extra chronic wasting disease funds that have been spent and that you're requesting, how many of those cases can be linked to deer farms?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Becker Finn, it's hard to make a direct one-to-one correlation that this deer was contaminated by this farm or this deer escaped from that farm. We can only use our best judgment. In certain areas of the state, we believe there has been cross-contamination from herds into the wild.
Thank you. So looking at what we have in the proposal, I mean, we've linked Crow Wing County Cervid Farm, Meeker County Cervid Farm, Winona County Cervid Farm, you know, Pine Island, you know, it looks like where you're doing those efforts is correlated with where the farms are that you have concerns, correct?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Becker-Finn.
Thank you. So how much money is coming out of any of the ag accounts to deal with any of this?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, none. I mean, the funding we received last year was a one-time appropriation out of the Heritage Enhancement Account, $500,000. As Ms. Julek spoke, we spent more than that. What this proposal would do is provide general fund for these activities so that the deer hunters and the hunters of the state and people providing money for the game and fish funds aren't responsible for paying the cost of this surveillance activity.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So obviously my concern is that the deer hunters are the ones that are paying for this. And they're also, you know, there's extra burdens on having to have the testing done and having to make sure that you're, you know, following the rules. You know, you can't just hunt and do your own thing if you've got to follow these extra provisions to make sure that we're being tested and that the meat is safe. I mean, do you expect this need for additional funds to grow over time or decline over time? You know, this is just your supplemental request, but if we're going to be smart about how we're spending our dollars and who's paying for what, you know, kind of long term, is this, or, you know, do you expect to continue to be asking for more funds in this area?
Mr. Chairman, members, that's the multi-million dollar question, right? We don't know until we get to continue the surveillance work what we're going to find. If we find additional animals in the southern, southeastern area, that's going to require additional testing ongoing. Hopefully in the Crow Wing County area, where we've been clean for a year, we get two more clean years, and then those costs are reduced dramatically in that area. But it's kind of a moving target right now, so there is a need to do these types of activities. And as we saw with the high path avian influenza, there was an account set aside for the Department of Ag to tap into for emergency situations. We may need to consider something like that for these wildlife diseases that are coming on as well into the future. But there's going to be a continued need. What that need is, I don't know. And I know, as you mentioned, the deer hunters and other hunters in the state feel they shouldn't be paying for some of these costs.
Representative Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Representative Brian Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Meyer, I'm just wondering if some of your testing to do some of the continued year-long testing, if you've thought of testing some of the carcasses from the car kills in these areas just to monitor year-round.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have not. Again, it's for a situation like that, it's going to depend on the state of the sample by the time we get there. Obviously, we need to have brain tissue that is still testable, and then it's just a matter of scale and, you know, one random dot versus a concentrated surveillance effort. So I can certainly talk to staff and see if it's viable or if it, maybe in certain areas of the state it might make sense at certain times. So,
President Johnson.
No more.
Okay. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Meyer, it sounds like where these detections are essentially biological Chernobyls that forever we are going to have to be monitoring them because we don't know what the answer is going to be. And so with the request for general fund dollars, now the public is picking up the tab beyond just the hunters. And I support the governor's request because I think we have to respond and do the monitoring, but I think that the tab is going to continue to increase. But, Mr. Chair, I actually have a different question.
Yeah, go ahead.
As long as Commissioner Meyer's there.
Sure.
So I noticed reading that the deer plan was released yesterday, and there are 35 public meetings scheduled in the state of Minnesota, and there is one in Shakopee, one in Rosemont, and one in Carlos Avery, zero in Hennepin County, zero in Ramsey County. Mr. Chair, I would ask how you would feel if there were 35 meetings scheduled and 32 of them were in the 7-county metro area, and 3 were in greater Minnesota. This has got to stop. It is discriminatory, and it is all too common in our state. If we want people to participate, there has to be fairness. The input we seek determines the outcome that we get. There are over 30,000 hunters in Hennepin County. It is the largest county where hunters reside. Zero public meetings.
Representative Hansen, was that a rhetoric question to me, or?
I would like, how would you feel?
Okay, I'll be happy to address that. You know, for me personally, and I haven't looked at the list of where the meetings are, and if somebody is here that has quick access to that, relative to Roseau, Minnesota, where the nearest meeting is going to be, okay, I guess I would look at more at proximity. When you live where I live, you know, driving 60 miles to go to a meeting, it's nothing. It's just something that we do, and we're kind of used to that. So with all due respect to the people in Hennepin, I personally wouldn't take offense to having to drive 15 miles to a meeting or 22, because we drive to Detroit Lakes once in a while for meetings with MPCA. That's 150 miles from Roseau. So, Representative Hansen, I understand your frustration to a certain degree, but you asked me a rhetorical question, and I'm responding in that, personally, I don't see it. I think it's good that they're having 35 meetings. Would you propose? Well, I'll leave it at that. So, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the issue is you couldn't have a meeting location unless we get the stadium for 30,000 people to come and provide input, regardless of how far they drive. And I just happened to bring the map of where people live who hunt. And I've got the counties here. So it's not just Hennepin where people live who hunt. It's St. Louis, Hennepin first, St. Louis, Anoka, Stearns, Dakota, Wright, Ramsey, Sherburne, Washington. This is the one where they live by zip code. So it's not just about travel. It's where are the hunters and how do they provide input.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Tuesday, April 17th at the Roseau County Courthouse, we will be talking about the beer.
That's about 0.4 miles from my house. So.
And hopefully
thank you.
At our next
and the people from Hennepin County are invited up if they would like. I'll buy the coffee and donuts.
In all seriousness, Mr. Yeah. Chairman, Representative Hansen does bring up a good question that I will look into and see what we can do. If you look on our webpage, there's an extensive list of those public meetings, the draft plan, and an opportunity to submit comments online as well. But I will work with Representative Hansen and see what we can do to try to even out that issue. So thank you for bringing it to our attention.
I've heard that some of the members of the Minnesota Vikings are deer hunters too, so maybe the stadium is available. Representative Newbin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Meyer, I'm so glad to hear you say that. I agree completely with Representative Hansen here. You know, you got to have something in Hennepin and Ramsey County. It's just, I'm hopeful that was an oversight on the DNR's part, because while I'd love to drive to Roseau and have coffee with you and go to a meeting, maybe not. It'd be a lot easier to go someplace else in Hennepin County or even Ramsey County. So I think it would be a very good move on your part, Bob. Thank you.
Sorry, I forgot, Representative Newcomb, you're used to going to Central Minnesota up to Walker.
Oh, Central Minnesota.
Yeah. The other interesting statistic that would be interesting to see is, of the populations of a county, what percentage are deer hunters? Representative Becker Kansas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just kind of to that point, it's not just that that's where the deer hunters are, that's where the people who are paying the licenses that pay the fees that allow us to implement the deer plan. So it does matter. And And to your point, Mr. Chair, as someone who grew up in rural Minnesota, I don't know how far away you live from the state office building, but
360 miles
during session. We have to deal with traffic down here. I know, you know, growing up, 30 miles to the grocery store was not a big deal because it was 30 minutes. That's not quite how it works here as far as accessibility for folks to get to meetings and meaningfully participate. So also hopeful that was just an oversight and that we can get that corrected at a stadium or not.
And I think you heard from DNR that they're willing to look at this, and there's, you know, there's potentially better ways to deal with this stuff, but we'll move on. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, at one point I was told, and I...
Could you speak into the microphone, please?
I do represent an urban area, a suburban one, too, that my legislative district had more hunters than most. So I'm assuming you still have some statistics about the number of hunters per legislative district, and that would be helpful to share with us as we look at this distribution of meetings.
Mr. Chairman, members, I will pull together what data I can and have it distributed to the county or to the committee.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Any closing comments, Ms. Julie or Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, I know in the coming weeks it's going to be very. The amount of money available to fund issues are going to be very limited, I think. The severity of the chronic wasting disease issue is very important to us, as well as our forest inventory and other things. But thank you for the ability to express those concerns and needs that we have for you today.
Well, I think you know that as chair of this committee, I'm committed to forestry, for example. You know, after the last session, the forestry division within the DNR was doing cartwheels. They were so happy with what this committee did for them for forestry. And I think that's a very important part. And anybody who questions my commitment to dealing with the CWD issue is not very well informed. So I'm willing to work with you and all members to see if we can't come to some sort of a reasonable solution. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just on that note, I know we will be talking about that after the auditor's report, but it's the department's intent not to close down the deer farms, to make sure that they're being managed the way they're supposed to be, and that we're protecting the wild cervids and also the captive cervids the best we can in the state. So that's our desire.
Well, and I will close by saying that as I was, but I don't know what actually made it into the publication that interviewed me last week. I've gotten very sick and tired of the finger-pointing that's been going on with regards to CWD within the agencies. We need to figure out a way to get this solved. Thank you. Next up, Representative Fisher, House File 3908. You got 3 minutes. No, I'm kidding. While you're getting ready, I'm going to get a cup of coffee. Representative Fisher, obviously. Would you like to move your House File 3908 I'll move to lay it over for possible inclusion. And if you would like, I will move your D2 amendment for you to get the bill in the shape that you would like.
Please, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate that.
I'll move that the for adoption of the DE2 amendment. Anybody, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the amendment's adopted. Members are working off a DE2. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present 3908. This is a continuation of the work to create the One Watershed concept. This is a concept that I became familiar with when I first started a few years ago. I was given the Minnesota Water Sustainability Framework handbook, which deals with a lot of the water issues that we have throughout the state. And one of the big things that kind of came out through here is that there were a lot of parts of our process that did not allow things to flow seamlessly together. Water in our state is not just surface water or groundwater. It's all one water that mixes together. But so often, so many of the laws that we had and statutes did not allow that to flow very well together. And also, it did not create a great opportunity to have different governmental agencies working together. One of the things that I know that when we were going through it is that the current Clean Water Act, the current laws, statutes that Bowser has, basically focuses on surface waters and only impaired surface waters. And the problem is that it ignores a lot of other issues that we have out there. It ignores our groundwater. It ignores our waters that are still high quality. It ignores waters that are slowly becoming impaired, but that does not allow us to start addressing things in those areas. Also, the way that there was the fragmentation occurring, it made a very complicated process. And so as a result, some of the things that this bill is going to do is allows the streamlining of the entities working together to help solve the issues, bringing people together under one umbrella, provides more flexibility in how we approach the implementation to make sure that as plans are being put together to protect our waters, it's protecting all waters, and also making sure that all the appropriate agencies are brought in together. And one of the things that we know is that water does not follow legislative or political boundaries. Water just does not stop flowing when it hits a city at the edge of a city. It continues flowing and follows the watershed. And so this helps bring that together, takes the next step in the process to streamline what we're trying to do. One of the things that we do know is that it's been a very complicated process because the current statute refers to federal law, and federal law only allows us to deal with waters that are impaired and only surface waters. And so one of the complicated parts of this bill that we have in front of us is to make sure that we're still keeping those protections in there, but being able to decouple it in a way so that we can fold in the protections and making the plans that we do to protect our waters more broad so that we will be protecting the groundwaters, developing plans that will protect waters that are still high quality and also waters that are starting to become impaired but are not currently listed as impaired. Some of the things that I also want to make sure that we keep in mind as we go through here is we have also worked hard to broaden the process to make sure that we still have good public input, and not only from the public, but making sure that all the different government and tribal agencies are being involved in it, and making sure that all the different interest groups that we have out there and the public have got an opportunity in providing input and address having their having their concerns addressed as we move through the process. And so that is an area that we did beef up a bit in the area. Another area that we know is an issue is non-point priority funding. We have a lot of non-point sources out there, and there's never been a real thought-out process of what does that look like? How do we set priorities when we're putting funding into sources that will help clean up and address issues around non-point issues. And one of the things that we realize is this is a very complex issue, is going to require a lot of time, so it puts a work group together to start getting at these kind of process to find out what is the best way to set up priority funding when we're doing allocation of funds down the road, particularly when we're taking a look at RAPs and some of the other issues that we use out there. What I'd like to do is I just wanted to touch on some bigger, broader issues. I also want to do is turn it over to some very smart people who work on the ground on these issues on a daily basis, and I'd like them to be able to provide some testimony as how this process is going to be more efficient for them, how it's going to allow them to be more effective out there. And so at this point, Mr. Chair, I'd like to be able to introduce it to my testifiers.
Proceed. Yes, go ahead. Ms. Buck, welcome.
Excuse me. Can you hear me?
Can you now?
Yep. There we go. Good morning. My name is Leanne Buck. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And our association, in part with the members that are here today, we're part of what we call ourselves the Local Government Water Roundtable. And so we have been, obviously my leadership training has always told me the collaborative process is the best process. So it's a proud opportunity to collaborate with our other local government partners. So what we look at is, as an association, we support House File 3908. It provides for modifications that allows my soil and water district members to move beyond just assessing and planning to accelerating actions. and best management practices on the landscape. So for us, that's what we do. That's what we want to do, and we want to move forward to continue to look at that implementation of those activities. As a member of the original G16 that took place back in 2003, we were formed. It was a diverse coalition of the state, local government, environmental, agricultural community, everybody. And through that process, what we were looking at is addressing federal Clean Water Act requirements and the implications for Minnesota. And I'd also like to acknowledge Ray Bone back in the day with the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, who was another local government partner that was right there hand in hand with everyone. The driving force back in 2003 and 2006 were TMDLs. There were lawsuits, there were litigation, and again, it was an issue that was complicated and there was some redundancies. So what we looked at is we went through a progression of state policy. So between the passage of the Clean Water Legacy Act, the constitutional amendment, the state-led effort called WRAPS, Watershed Restoration Protection Strategies, again, those policies, and there's been an evolution as we continue to address some of these issues. At the same time, then we saw as local governments we need to continue to partner and look at how we can better do work at the local level. And for us, that created policy called the One Watershed, One Plan. And again, we're in the early phases of that. We have five pilots that are being done, and it's continuing to grow and move and have a collaborative effort when we're looking locally. But also what it does is bringing science that the MPCA and other agencies have. So we have that information and that as we look at our strategies. So again, before you, this bill before you today is acknowledging those previous policies, and it also moves us to removing redundancies. But for me, it's about empowering local governments to the boots on the ground, to continue to engage the citizens, work together on activities, and also blend those components of federal government, state government, and local government so we can, again, do it in a collaborative effort to address some of our water quality issues. So to me, this is a bill that looks at continuous improvement of our existing policies that have a heavy emphasis, obviously, back in 2003 with surface water. So we know we need to move into other areas, but again, this is a continuous improvement bill for us.
Thank you. The new Ray Bone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Chair Fabian, members. My name is Emily Javens. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts. I've been in that role for just a few months. Before that, I was the Administrator of the Yellow Medicine River Watershed District, and I was one of those pilots. And, of course, when you work on a pilot, you find out what works really well and what works not so well. And we were able to identify a few things that could be improved, and those things that could be improved are in this bill. One of the things was the state came in and they worked on the Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategy, like Leanne talked about, the RAFs. That was great. It was great to have the MPCA come in. They did some science that was beyond what we could do out there on our own. They built a model for us and told us where our impairments were. And that was great. At the end of that, they were required to do some citizen engagement and ask the citizens, what waters do you care about the most, and what are you willing to do about it? Then they put together a table of what we should do to fix the water. Well, then we started the One Watershed, One Plan, and we had to do the same thing. We had to ask those same citizens, what waters do you care about the most, and what are you willing to do about it? They had just been asked this, and so that you could see there was some overlap there. And then we really sat down and decided, what will we do to fix these waters, and came up with a strategy. The strategy that's in the RAFs, we won't ever look at that again, to be honest with you, but we are invested in the one that we created locally through our really intense stakeholder involvement, and it's a flexible. The MPCA actually built the tool for us that we can continue to change those strategies. So let's say the next farm bill comes out and you just absolutely can't not put cover crops in. We can run that model and say, what would happen to our water if we had cover crops on 30% of the land out there? And we can find out how that would react. So we have this great model. We have great tools to do that. But we did do it twice, and now the RAPS is done, and they're getting ready to come back and do it again because it says in law that every 10 years you have to go through this cycle. Representative Swazinski, you live out there. How much of the land use do you think is going to change in the last few years? Not necessarily a lot. Not so much that we would have to rerun that model and redo it. So there is not necessarily a good reason to redo all of that science. And so this bill also allows some flexibility to look at it and say, you know what, let's just do what needs to be done. And if there isn't a lot that's needed, let's not do it. And we also, what this will allow, instead of getting trapped in planning and planning and planning, we can move to implementation. We have brought in a lot of federal dollars just recently, two large grants, to now move straight into putting projects on the ground. And we're pretty excited because Lake Shakotan out there just came off the impaired waters list, and our strategy is then to add best management practices in those areas right downstream of Lake Shakotan and try and clean up that stream that's red on the map because that's impaired. But we've got clean water coming out of Shakotan. We've got a strategy. We've got money. We want to go, and we want to stop being so tied down to repetitive planning, especially when it's not necessary and it's overlapping. So that's what we see as the best benefit of this, and we ask for your support on this House file.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jennifer Berklom, policy analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties and also representing the Minnesota County and Zoning Administrators today. Counties also support House File 3908 and would like to thank Representative Fisher for bringing this bill forward. We also thank Chair Fabian and committee members this morning for taking time to hear the bill. We greatly appreciate the partnerships with SWCDs and watershed districts and concur with their comments this morning. And also those comments that Representative Fisher made. He clearly has great background in water issues, so thank you for your work on this bill. Counties particularly support Sections 1 and 2 of the bill to ensure that resources will be available to local governments to implement coordinated water management plans and facilitate on-the-ground projects to improve and enhance our state's water resources. And I think my previous testifiers did a great job pointing out some of the other aspects of this bill and the positive points, and we just would ask for your support this morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Member questions? Representative Wagenius.
What I hear and what I read.
Forgot the microphone.
What I hear and what I read seem to be different, so let's just talk about that for a minute. What I hear from you is that we need to look at both groundwater and surface water together, and I, of course, agree with that. And I hear that you want to bring in science. It's terrific. I hear that you want to get rid of repetitive planning. What I didn't hear is about some of the stuff I'm reading in here is getting rid of outcomes. And instead of having performance-based standards, you just want to get rid of that. So when we started with clean water money, one of the things we talked about was measuring, because you can't manage what you don't measure. And we talked about outcomes, and we talked about performance. And I looked at some of the language, like on page 1, line 121, you're getting rid of performance-based. I look at line 2.3, and you're saying performance-based or eligibility criteria. Well, eligibility criteria could be we're going to have 5 teenagers on the stakeholder group. That the or is big. I looked at section 7, 3.14, it says, instead of achieve and maintain, now we're adding the word pursue. So that means process. We're going back to the bad old days. Just process. I look at page 4, and which is information, 4.4, information to support. Not outcomes, not performance, just information. So at that point, I kind of gave up reading here. It troubles me a lot that we're not using measurements and we're not using, we're just saying we want to do projects. We're not saying we're going to measure our outcomes in the law. So we're getting rid of that. And I think we're going backwards. So I hear one thing and I'm seeing another.
Representative Fisher. I'll start tackling parts of that. First of all, when we're taking a look at parts one and pages one and two through there, part of what this is addressing is the eligibility to address situations that come up on a very quick basis. Sometimes there are situations where a disaster has occurred, severe erosion is occurring. This gives the flexibility to be able to address those kind of situations with a little bit more flexibility and being a little bit more nimble in those areas. The other sessions, I know that as we're talking about evaluations, those have been moved into the different sections, and I'm looking for my notes as to where we moved them to, where we were expanding the evaluation process further on, and I believe, and I'm looking down around 5-2, and I think where it is, I can get my phone a friend here too. Okay, 6-1 is expanded waters.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, yep. Andy Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I think as I heard the question about performance-based, this is the performance-based discussion in here on page one was to address exactly what Representative Fisher said, that there are times when the legislature appropriates a grant based on something else, so based on a formula. For example, the buffer cost share was based on, you know, some in the CREP area and some outside of the CREP area. And so that would be a case that would not be a performance-based case. Performance-based is key and critical to one watershed, one plan, funding, and others. And so it's not that performance goes away. And I think the part, Representative Wagenius, that you were talking to on 1.21, with that strikeout was a technical or mechanical strikeout to keep it at the same level, because this is just talking about all-inclusive for an advanced basis. So that was just to clean it up to match 1.5.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the delete all is better than the first version. Following up on Representative Wagenius, one of my concerns is on 3.13, where restoration means actions including effectiveness monitoring that are taken to achieve and maintain water quality. So is there anywhere else in kind of this bedrock statute where the words effectiveness monitoring appear?
Mr. Chair and members, so this was a technical correction, because this is in the definition of restoration, and so it's taking restoration and having it read clearer, and then a monitoring is put back in 4.16. And so 4.16 says to systematically evaluate waters that provide assistance incentives to prepare waters from becoming impaired. So it's added back in a place that that is more inclusive than just restoration, it includes protection.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so from the agency's perspective, evaluating waters includes effectiveness monitoring?
Mr. Chair, yes. Members, yes.
And Mr. Chair, maybe as this moves on, that might be something just to put a clause in there. I'd feel a little more comfortable, but that I have a larger question just in general on to the testifiers. I think the question of process is legitimate. We're now 10 years past the passage of the constitutional amendment. We're 12 years past Clean Water Legacy, and I And I think Minnesotans want to make sure that we're actually cleaning up impaired waters and that we're preventing further degradation. So does this actually do that, or are we shuffling process around here? Do we actually get, or is cleanup is the first to water better water quality, put it that way. Does this get us to better water quality? And then two, which is the conundrum question, what do we do? I mean, I think this assumes that all locals are awesome, that everybody's working great, and we know that with human nature, that's not always the question, not always the outcome, and not everything's always awesome. So what do you do where maybe the local governments don't want to do something? How do you get folks, either because of their ability or willingness or financial resources, will not do the tasks necessary or the projects necessary to implement water quality protection?
A couple, two, three questions there to the testifiers. Representative Fisher.
Well, I'll let my testifiers go first, and I'll just follow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, one of the things about local government is local autonomy, and I was recently at a county commissioner meeting and in the metropolitan area, and they said one county is like a large, you know, you've seen one county, you've seen them all, or you haven't seen them all, because it is that uniqueness. So where I see the strength of one watershed, one plan, is not having specific one entity being responsible for one thing only. So this collaborative effort is learning and understanding. There's that theory of, you know, give a man a fish to eat for a day, teach him to fish, they'll, you know, eat for a lifetime. And so going through the one watershed, one planning process has accelerated the understanding and the diversity at the local level, as well as bringing that science and that information we didn't have at the local level. We're not scientists at the local, and we're not going to pretend to be. At the same time, the scientists at some of the agencies in St. Paul's probably aren't the implementers. So again, we're trying to bridge those factors. So can I promise you that everybody's going to do everything at the same time? I'll be honest, probably not. But what I am looking at is more of a solid foundation of sharing of information and resources among local governments, and then to utilize the state agency's expertise that where they have that and how to do that as we transition into working with landowners across the state. So I wish I had a pure answer for you, and it's a fair question. But again, we're continuing to ramp it up, and that's why we're supportive of the One Watershed, One Plan. And again, previous to this, all of this was focused on TMDLs. And so I think the uniqueness, too, is we've got a lot of protection strategies. You get into Couchiching County, you get into Crow Wing County, and you look at the efforts there that locals are saying, we want to go beyond just a TMDL effort.
Jeff Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's a fair concern because there are some areas that may be resistant to not wanting to do their part. That's one of the problems that we have out there. That was a problem that was existing before this bill came along. It's a problem that we were not able to address at this point in time. What we are doing is taking a step right now to expand out. This bill was not able to address every single problem out there, but another step in the process. It's like when the One Watershed was first created a few years ago. That was the first step in the process. There are going to be many more steps that we'll have to go through as we go down the road. This is not something that is a panacea that's going to cure all at one time. But the continuation of an evolution of process as we learn more that we can implement as we go forward. So this is not the last bill that will ever address this. We're going to have more work that we do as we go down the road. But because of the complexities of some of those issues, we'd like to move along where we've got some agreement on and then come back and continue to work on the areas where there's still disagreement and where there's controversy so that we don't ignore those in the process.
Panacea. Okay. Ms. Javens.
One thing I want to remind you of, too, is that the One Watershed, One Plan is based on that prioritized target measure, and you absolutely have to measure. And now when we're moving the grants to the not competitive anymore, and because we've gone through the hard work, the money is coming right into our watershed, we have to prove that we are working hard. And let me tell you, Bowser does keep very good track of how well we are doing, and it's very performance-based. And so I feel like that really we have been very accountable. And Representative Wagenius, I wanted to correct one thing that you mentioned on line 4.4, where we took out the implementation table and used information to support. That is in the RAPS, when I talked about how they put together that large strategy table and then we redid it. That's saying let the MPCA do the science that really empowers us to then figure out what the implementation is going to be. So that is why we cleaned up that sentence, was to have them kind of stop at the science, turn over implementation to the locals. That was the intention of that.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, about probably 20 years ago, I worked with the Minnesota Resource Council on starting to develop forestry landscape plans. So I'm wondering on Section 12, Subdivision 5, about line 5.32, page 5, Mr. Chair, if the author would accept a friendly amendment to add the Minnesota Forest Resource Council as one of the groups to be an active member when preparing the RAPs and TMDLs.
I'm sorry, what's the line number on that again?
On page 5, section 12, subdivision 5, 5.32.
I would be open to that. What we're trying to do is make sure that we've got as many people as possible of the groups involved with this. I'd be open to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Minnesota Forest Resource Council has been active in working on these watershed and landscape plans, so I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Is there someone here from the council that wants to
Yes, yes, there is, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Oh, okay.
Jeez. Mr. Chair, Ganston, Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resource Council. As Mr. Eklund noted, the work that the Forest Resource Council does relative to forest disturbance is a very important component of not only our landscape plans, but our research and applied research work that we do, particularly on forest disturbance and distinguishing between perennial and annual crop cover. It is a very important element of water quality. And oftentimes we somewhat just talk about forest disturbance in a generic sense, and the research that we do work on has a very huge role in RAPs and one watershed plan. So we appreciate the ability of our council to fold in formally the work that we do to their efforts, and it's an area that we'll be working on quite a bit in the coming years. So I think this would be a great fit for the applied research we do related to water and forest disturbance, and forests are one of the best filters for our watershed. So we think that it's a very important element for our state. And Mr. Chair, if there's any specific questions, I'm happy to answer that.
Jim Eklund. To this point, okay, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, this is being held over for possible inclusion, so I think it would be wise to think about wordsmithing this, because I want to make sure that this is a must clause, and so there may be areas of the state where the Forest Resource Council may not be needed, so it should be something where it's applicable. So if Representative Eklund and you could work together, if you're open to that, on and Ms. Taylor, to make sure that we get it right if we want to put this in, and with the author.
Sure. We'll continue working on this. Representative Fisher and Eklund and Ms. Taylor. And, before we move on, members, I would like to get Paul Nelson down here. And I know, Representative Wagenius, you're on the list. And we'll circle back to you. And then Director Becker Kadelka, I'd like to get your official testimony on this. You answered some questions and phone a friend. Good morning.
Good morning.
Identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Paul Nelson. I'm the Environmental Services Program Manager for Scott County, and I'm here on behalf of Scott County and myself to say that we support this legislation. I'm going to go off script for about a minute and to Representative Hansen's questions in terms of, will this bill help us get to water quality? And I would say yes, because of the alignment in the planning and the flexibility that provides us locally. I can have my staff dedicate more time to getting things on the ground rather than writing things and doing plans. Secondly, where locals don't want to do things. I've talked with a number of you. I've been in this business for 35 years. 15 years of that in sort of the planning and the study side of this, more recently, the last 20, in implementing. And most recently, looking really into the social aspects of doing water quality by landowners themselves. And then that question of when people don't really want to do things, what I find in my experiences, and this is borne out in research, is that, you know, people don't get up in the morning and say, okay, today I'm going to go pollute. Yeehaw. That's not what they do. The things that control whether or not they implement are, one, have they been asked by someone they trust? A plan doesn't necessarily motivate them to do something. Being asked does, especially by someone they trust. My staff, we need the time to work with people to develop that kind of trust. Second thing that they need is belief. They need to believe that their hard work will make a difference. Again, that comes from implementation, seeing things work, seeing water quality change, and so forth. Third, they need to believe that they have the ability. It fits within their business plan. It fits within what they want to do with their property. That's, again, where my staff comes in, SWCD staff comes in, some of the financial assistance to help people with the financial assistance to do it, to provide that technical assistance to be able to have that belief that they can. It also comes from seeing their neighbors implement. You get a little bit of momentum when they see other people doing stuff and they start to believe, my neighbor can do it, I can do it. And then lastly, and I forgot.
You took the same memory improvement class that I did.
That's the problem with going off script. But I would say that I don't worry particularly overly with people who don't immediately get on board. I work with the people who get on board and through them convert others. And so this flexibility, this ability to implement through the process so far, you've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in plans from Clean Water Fund. And I think previous testifiers said this best. This is an evolution. This is a learning process. This is the next step to better align things to go forward and do better for water quality. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Your testimony is spot on. I've said many, many times you can accomplish a lot more with a cup of coffee and a carrot than you can with a club. And I think that we've seen that in some of the things that we've done here in the last few years, that you mentioned landowners trusting agencies and so forth, absolutely critical and essential. And there's a lot of distrust out there in rural Minnesota right now. Mr. Nelson.
I was just going to add, I said this at the Senate, and people looked at me a little weird, but my best tool is a thank you card.
Very well said. Thank you. Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Members, again, for the record, Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, just in summary, House File 3908 provides process improvements to achieve coordinated watershed management, and Bowser supports the author's delete all. Minnesota's model of conservation delivery is really locally led conservation. And the experts that you heard from today, the counties and the watershed districts and the soil and watershed districts, are the ones out there that are trying to work with all of these different processes. Bowser every year travels around the state to hear from our local government partners about what's working and maybe more importantly, what's not and what can work better. And this is what we've heard consistently across the state has been planning fatigue, study fatigue, public confusion, and it's around process and not around content. And so what this really does is this bill looks to better align data, analysis, planning, and implementation to get to cleaner water faster. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Borgenius.
Thank you. I hear some words and I read something differently, but just in sum, it seems like if you get rid of performance-based grants, you're getting rid of the outcomes from individual grants and saying we're going to test waters in the end, and that's our measurement, then we have no way of knowing which things were effective and which things were not effective, because we are piling the effective things together with the things that are not effective or marginally effective. So we will have no way of knowing how taxpayers' dollars are being, whether taxpayers' dollars are being spent effectively or not. So if you're going to go this route, it does seem to me we have to have some ways of measuring that are not in here, because otherwise we have now kind of thrown the baby of measurement out. We've just thrown it out. This is like, feels like 10 years of work, and it's just evaporated. So, Mr. Chair, I think as you're looking for wordsmithing, let's not, in the name of flexibility, let's not lose our ability to measure what works and what doesn't work.
Comments, testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I agree with you wholeheartedly that performance and performance management and measurement is critical in the evolution. And so so I agree completely. The this bill does not take away performance-based, and in fact, the agency still uses that as a primary mechanism by which to provide, especially with competitive grants, and to assess the effectiveness of those dollars that have been appropriated out to our local government partners. This the additional language in here doesn't take away any standards or any responsibilities. It provides for when we are appropriated dollars that should be formula-driven, so based on the number of miles in a certain area, you know, for cost-share dollars, for example, or a set amount of dollars that go out based on a legislation. This is being inclusive of that, that we don't do an additional process before we get those dollars out the door. And I agree with you that performance-based and measurement is key. It's critical to moving ahead. And so this bill does not diminish any current authorities or standards.
Any other questions, members? So, okay. Representative Clark Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to ask a question. Ms. Becker-Kadelka, you talked about you've heard across the state, and my compliments. I know you guys do listen, and I agree with the local control efforts. Have you heard from across the state that there's a desire to remove the performance-based focus of the current law?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, we have heard, and I think the testifiers, the Association of Minnesota Counties, as Ms. Berquam alluded to, there have been situations, and this is in Section 1 and 2, where local governments have been slowed down or with these base dollars that are sometimes very tiny amounts of base dollars, like in the Natural Resource Block Grant. So it's a base amount of money that goes out the door. And that when that money goes out the door, all of the performance-based measures that go with it before the money goes out the door don't make sense to tie with, in some cases, a few thousand dollars for a specific project or program that's already been established in statute. And so it's not that that performance base still isn't important. It's just segmenting out some of those base appropriations that Bowser has that we must give out based on already pre-existing formulas.
Okay, thank you. Okay, members, with that, House File 3908, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion, and the work will continue with Representative Fisher and Eklund and Wagenius. Anything else? Thank you. We're adjourned.